This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Good afternoon, Winnipeg. Good afternoon, Manitoba. And for all those joining us live this afternoon at TSN1290.ca, good afternoon, universe, and welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. 3 hours of hockey talk for you on this Saturday afternoon. I'm your host, Drew Mindell, alongside my colleagues Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. Producer Remus gets us on and off the air. Joining us on the program today from ESPNDenver.com to preview tomorrow night's Jets Avalanche game, Drew Spivak is going to join us in about 30 minutes' time. At 2 o'clock this afternoon, Michael Russo from the Minneapolis Star Tribune is going to join us, talk about the Minnesota Wild. They signed a couple of players to contract extensions, talk about the Central Division rival of your Winnipeg Jets in the final hour of the show. And Saturday Spotlight this week, Andy Murray, former Team Canada head coach, former Winnipeg Jets assistant coach, former head coach of the Los Angeles Kings and the St. Louis Blues, and currently the head coach of the Western Michigan Broncos. That'll be at the top of the next hour. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and NHL news is IllegalCurve.com. We start the show this Saturday afternoon by looking back at last night's Winnipeg Jets versus Tampa Bay Lightning game, a game that the Jets lose by a score of 4-2. A game in which I thought, gentlemen, that for the first 20 or 25 minutes, really the first period and part of the second period, the Winnipeg Jets were the better of the two teams and had more scoring opportunities than the Tampa Bay Lightning did. And if it wasn't for the play of Ben Bishop in the first period and the Jets' failure to execute and really take advantage of opportunities they had, namely the 5-on-3 power play, it could have been a different game, but alas, they didn't take advantage. Tampa Bay took advantage of their opportunities, largely as a result of Winnipeg Jets' poor decisions and miscues. And before you know it, Tampa Bay exits Winnipeg by doubling them up 4-2.
Right, and Steven Stamkos got the early goal 4 minutes into the game, and that really seemed to deflate the crowd. I thought, you know, just as an aside, I thought the pregame ceremony was very well done. The moment of silence for the two fallen soldiers, it was really well done, and I thought the crowd was really into it. So Stamkos's goal, you know, the beautiful pass from Drew End, really kind of quieted the crowd a little bit. But you're right, Drew. The Jets had chances. They had 16 shots in the first period, and you know they outshot the Lightning. I think it was 14-6 in the second period. The Lightning, of course, got three goals on those six shots, Richie. But no, I thought they played a good game, and you know they were trading chances with the Tampa Bay Lightning. And hey, guys, Ben Bishop is an excellent goaltender. Last year was a coming out party for Ben Bishop. He's the type of goalie that he just takes up so much room. I was telling you guys, you know, in the dressing room after the game, standing beside him, I mean, I felt like a lot shorter than I am, and I'm not that tall at 5'9", but he's 6'7", 6'8".
You have the presence of somebody about 6'5", though, as
I guess the beard adds a little bit of presence, but you know, the guy is an excellent goaltender, and they couldn't really find an answer. You know, Brian Little got the power play goal. The Jets finally get a power play goal there in the second period. Then, you know, later on in the period, the Lightning respond. You know, Namestnikov and Palat scored goals. And to me, you know, after those two goals, they regained the two-goal lead.
We're going to go goal by goal, and we'll talk about what happened on each individual goal to look at the breakdowns. Richie, sort of your overview of the game before we start with the Steven Stamkos goal that gave the Lightning the 1-0 lead.
Well, Tampa just able to play a faster, more skilled game, and their pace is great. They play as a you know, they say the five-man unit, but they play as a five-man unit a lot better than the Jets do. They break the puck out a heck of a lot better than the Jets do. Their game is more crisp, and it's done at a faster pace. And that's like the big picture. You know, you talk about Bishop, and certainly he's a factor as well. We'll talk about, you know, Pavlik and the goals against him, I'm sure. But there's a skill level difference. But even, you know, the Jets with the guys like Postma, who's more offensively inclined, you know, Enstrom, you think Bogosian, even Klitsam, like, what are the strengths of these guys' games? Yet the Jets can't really consistently make solid breakout passes and hit guys, you know, with speed. And there's just no cohesiveness to the game. There's no crispness to their game, and that's a huge problem. And you know, you talk about turnovers, or it's just the opportunity. It's not always a turnover, right, guys? Sometimes it's a pass that's behind a guy, or it's in the guy's skates, and he gets it, but he's not getting it with speed, and then he has got to put it in the corner. He's got to pass it back. Timing. The Jets just aren't playing a confident game at all right now. And yesterday, you know, they had their moments for sure. I mean, they played a really nice first half of the game, and they had some chances. But overall, you got to get results. You're 2-5 now, and you're going on a 4-game road trip. Three of which are, you know, in the East Coast there against the Rangers, Islanders, and Devils, and you're playing the Hawks on Sunday,
back to back after the Rangers.
This could get real ugly.
The Tampa Bay Lightning opened the scoring at 4:41 of the first period. Steven Stamkos with the goal, assist to Drouin and Filippula.
He gets a little bit of support from Drouin, who got it up to Stamkos, and a 2-on-1. Stamkos across the line for Drouin, back for Stamkos, a shot, he scores.
Of course, I meant Filippula, not Filippula, but whatever. We're off to a good start.
Well, it's a tough name to pronounce.
But actually, I'm okay at that one. I'm good at Filippula normally. So, what did you see on that first goal that gave the Lightning the 1-0 lead at the 4:41 mark?
Well, you know, Drew, I mean, what you do see is you see Grant Clitson trying to keep the puck in on Drouin in the offensive zone, and he just gets beat. Like, that's really what you're seeing there, because there's only two Lightning guys at the blue line. It's Stamkos. And it's Drouin, and Drouin just goes right around Klitsam, and then there's a nice pass back and forth. Drouin, Stamkos' skill level is through the roof. You could argue nobody on the Jets has skill levels like these two guys. And while they're making the passes back, Klitsam also doesn't get back in time to take Stamkos. I thought what Klitsam could have done on the goal, obviously he made a bad decision, you know, at the blue line, but what he could have done on the goal even was keep his feet moving, even slash Stamkos' stick, even break the stick, take a penalty just to be able to prevent the best goal scorer in the league from getting an open opportunity on his off wing, and he didn't do that.
Yeah, Klitsam unfortunately was a bad pinch. I actually think in Klitsam's first two games he's done a pretty good job. I think he's been effective after not playing in the first five games, and it was a bad pinch. And as Richie said, when you have Jonathan Drouin, who's obviously only played three games in the NHL, but we know what his skill set is from his play in the QMJHL, when you have those guys on a 2-on-1, and then it's a 2-on-1 with Bogo, and then Klitsam's late to get back, and as Richie said, he doesn't disrupt Stamkos, and he's able to bury it. So it was one of those goals. If you make those kinds of mistakes, a team like Tampa Bay will bury you. And it's not just Stamkos. They have a lot of guys that can do that. We saw that with Palat and Johnson. So that one was a miscue.
The first period ended 1-0 for Tampa Bay, but not before the Jets had a two-man advantage for almost a minute and 20 seconds. Now, the alignment on this two-man advantage, we were talking about this last night up in the press box, the alignment on this two-man advantage, Richard, caught your eye as being something that you weren't necessarily enamored of.
Well, I realize that the Jets have problems, Drew, in terms of the shots. They basically have problems if they're playing on a 5-on-3 and the alignment that they were using. They don't really have anybody on the... on the right side of the point, who can shoot the puck, really.
Somebody with a strong left-handed shot.
Yeah, exactly. Enstrom doesn't have that shot. Maybe you're looking at Klitsam, possibly, but that's like your really only other alternative. So it's a Klitsam. So what they did, they ended up putting Wheeler there. Wheeler doesn't have the best shot or the quickest release in his shot, and he's a right-handed shot. So if the puck goes back there, he's got to square up before he shoots. I just thought the alignment was an odd alignment, and I realized Paul Maurice only has a certain amount of players he can call on there. So it's a personnel issue as well. And I know that I was told that they've been practicing with that format before, so it wasn't like the first time they tried it by any means, but it just seemed like an odd alignment to me, and they had some chances there. But again, the power play was becoming pretty predictable, I thought.
Yeah, Blake Wheeler had 8 shots last night. I think half of those were on the power play.
The Lightning made it 2-0 in the second period at the 4:45 mark. Jonathan Drouin with his first goal in the NHL, assist to Nikita Kucherov and Tyler Johnson.
Johnson on the far side for Tampa, cross the line, tried to feed it back there for Drouin, and the pass was off a stick in toward the corner. Drouin coming toward the net, lets his shot go on a feed pass from behind the goal, and he beats Pavlik, and it's 2-0 for Tampa Bay.
What'd you see on this goal? Drouin, obviously, one he'll remember for the rest of his career, given that it's his first in the NHL.
I mean, the guy's kind of man up in the defensive zone, so Mark Stewart takes his guy who's behind the net, and Stewart doesn't fall behind the net, which lots of teams don't. Trouba mans up and takes his guy, Tyler Johnson. Now, it ends up being that Stewart kind of cheats towards Johnson, the pass to Johnson on the offside, and Trouba kind of follows Johnson as well. So Drouin comes back door, and it's a really nice pass by Kucherov on the one-timer. And every goal was a one-timer last night on Pavlik. But Adam Lowry takes Drouin out against the boards and then in the offensive zone and then doesn't follow him to the net. Young guy, you know, center, rookie, a lot of pressure. Defensively, there's a lot of responsibility. And he leaves his guy there. I think he was primarily responsible. Maybe you don't love the defense reads, but I would say Lowry, if he takes his guy, there's no issue with it in any event.
Right, and you had Andre Pavlik cheating to the side that Mark Stewart was watching Kucherov
and Stewart,
on.
But in Pavlik's defense, if he's watching his D, Stewart and Trouba are also going that way.
Right.
So if he's reading, because he's not looking necessarily, if he's reading based on his defenseman, he's going where they're looking, like the puck's going.
Richie, that's your classic backdoor play. I mean, it's one of those plays where Stewart, again, Richie, you know, already mentioned this, but Stewart's watching Kucherov kind of spying, if you want to look at it like that, when you spy the quarterback. And he's not going to fall him behind the net, because if he falls him behind the net, he's going to come out and have a shot. So it was one of those goals where, again, the pace at which Tampa Bay plays, and Colorado's another team, guys, by the way, that plays very, they can make these plays. And I thought Kucherov was very impressive. He was a guy that played about half the season for Tampa Bay last year and didn't play a lot in that Montreal series that they were swept. He's a guy that really impressed me. Lots of skill. But it's one of those plays where, you know, Lowry unfortunately doesn't pick up Drouin going to the net, and, you know, Pavlik's cheating to one side, and, you know, it takes half a second, the goal's in the net.
The Jets were able to cut the lead in half at the 5:33 mark, finally getting their first power play goal of the year. Brian Little, his fourth of the year, assist to Toby Enstrom and Andrew Ladd.
Trouba, but beaten the puck there by Palat, and it gets it all the way down the ice. Enstrom will skate to center, feed it on the far side for Ladd. Back in toward the corner for Enstrom, out in front for Little, a shot, he scores!
Jets finally get that first power play goal of the year. It took a long time, their seventh game, to finally get it. Little was the recipient of it. What do you think of that goal?
Well, I mean, I thought it was all Enstrom, really. And Tampa's going to kind of back off on the pressure and on the penalty kill, what they were doing last night. And so I kind of really like what they did. Enstrom comes in with speed, passes to Ladd, kind of throws him off, and Ladd tips it in to Enstrom. Enstrom re-picks up the puck, goes past Stroman. It kind of slowed them down for a second, Tampa, and then they picked up the speed again, the Jets did, and Enstrom beats Stroman wide, and then as Brewer's coming to cover up, kind of a mini two-on-one, although Palat's supporting there, Enstrom makes a really nice pass before Brewer's able to take away that lane. Little grabs the puck and takes a quick shot, which is important here. Doesn't hold on to it too long. Quick shot. Quick wrist shot, and the puck's in the net. So I thought it was a really nice execution by the Jets there. I thought Enstrom, you know, he had some plays defensively that made me question, you know, his judgment, but offensively I thought he was very good last night, carrying the puck really well, making some nice plays.
Yeah, and he usually is. I mean, the power play goes through Tobias Enstrom and Dustin Byfuglien, and it has guys since the Thrashers came over here, you know, with those two guys on the point, they've got tons of skill, and you know, Enstrom has the ability to make those plays, and you almost have to wonder if Paul Maurice is maybe going to encourage him to maybe jump up into the play as opposed to kind of taking that spot, you know, at the blue line, because Enstrom's a slick stick handler. He has the ability, and, you know, he gets criticized, you know, for not being able to handle larger forwards in his own zone sometimes, but as far as, you know, his offensive game, he's been there, you know, the whole year. I mean, he's been the Jets' best defenseman, in my opinion, all season. You know, no offense to Zach Bogosian or Jacob Trouba or other defensemen, but, you know, Tobias Enstrom is the leader of this D group. And, you know, on that goal, he did a great job to, you know, get around the Tampa defender. I forget who it was. Maybe it was Eric Brewer or the forward.
Stroman.
There. Or Stroman, sorry. And made a beautiful feed to Little, as Richie said, and you know, it's amazing that it took the Jets seven games to get a power play goal. Yeah. But hopefully this you know, takes some pressure off them, and they can get some more tomorrow afternoon.
Namestnikov made it regained the two goal lead for the Tampa Bay Lightning at the 12:52 mark. It's a power play goal for the Lightning, his second on the year, assist to Palat and Nikita Kucherov.
Namestnikov for Palat. Battle going on in front of the net with Bogosian and Morrow. Near side now, Kucherov back out in front of shot, they score! A one-timer! And it's Andre Palat with some good puck work. And finally, Palat left alone to come off the boards into the slot. Tape to tape, hammer time. It's a power play goal here for Tampa Bay. They've restored their two-goal lead. It's 3-1.
We hear Paul Edmonds there in his call of the game say that it was a tape-to-tape pass, and Palat was unmarked in the slot. We were up in the press box, and we were counting the number of sort of cross-ice passes from one, the left side of the ice to the right side of the ice or vice versa that the Lightning were able to make right in the slot. And it seemed like that was a weakness for the Jets the entire game last night.
Yeah, they were probably giving up that pass too much, Rich, Drew. I wanted to say one thing, though. On that goal, and we were talking about this as well as it was happening, Zach Bogosian and Brendan Morrow were having probably the best battle of the game in front of that net, because Brendan Morrow gives up 3 or 4 inches to Zach Bogosian, but they were really going at it, and Bogo was cross-checking Morrow, and Morrow was giving it back to him. I love that, because I'm a huge Brendan Morrow fan. But on that goal, I almost felt like that was a distraction in front of the net. And, you know, you talk about the pass to Namestnikov, who I hadn't seen play much before this year, and that seemed to be something that was never picked up, Richie. They didn't make that adjustment. And you saw that later in the game, even at even strength. And, you know, it's a good shot by Palat, and it's tipped, you know, but you can't really blame Pavlik for that. But, you know, that's something that the Tampa Bay Lightning, and we've seen that with other teams that have stretched the Jets out, and it's something that really needed to be picked up in the game.
I thought on this goal specifically, the Tampa's moving the puck from one side of the ice to the other, and on the power play, Jason Garrison, you know, skates the line and is able to do that. I thought the Jets might have had a little bit of an issue adjusting to the second unit's setup as opposed to the first unit. It's quite different. The first unit really kind of goes through Stamkos on the off wing. Second unit has a different setup completely based on the talent, based on the personnel, which you'll see in certain teams. Of course, they'll change it up based on what unit's out there, especially if they keep the same units together all the time. What happens here, guys, is Garrison moves the puck to the other side, and being the left side of the ice, if you're looking from the Jets end, and he passes that puck to Kucherov. Scheifele is pretty up close on Garrison because he wants to take away the shot. Garrison's got a good shot. Wheeler's probably a little bit too low because there's really nobody to take away on his side. And Enstrom doesn't rotate high enough to the shooter, which is Palat. So there's a couple mistakes here. It ends up leaving a large gap.
Yep.
Now, credit to Kucherov for identifying it so quickly that the pass from Garrison to Kucherov immediately passes that through the seam. But you have to understand something here. Kucherov's not going to shoot from there because he's a left-handed guy on a strong side. He's, like we said about Wheeler earlier, he would have to have turned around and taken the shot. So you have to know the possibility of a pass is more dangerous than a shot there. Just understanding the situation. And I thought it wasn't a great read there. He makes a beautiful pass. Credit to what credit's due. Beautiful pass through the seam. Palat takes a shot. It goes off to Namestnikov. But the idea is, it's good execution by Tampa, but it's also just knowing the situation and the Jets' execution. And I thought it was a little bit lacking there.
It's 3-1 for Tampa at that point, at the 18:02 mark of the second period, rather. They make it 4-1. Palat gets his third on the year. Was it a 3-point night for him?
Yep.
No, it was a 2-point night for him. Pardon me. Palat gets his third on the year, assist to Tyler Johnson and Nikita Kucherov. It's 4-1 at that point. Here's that goal.
Tampa Bay's got a 2-on-1. Here's Tyler Johnson across the line, slips to near side. Palat shoots and scores! A neutralized turnover results in a 2-on-1, and they march down in transition again. And it happens so quick, and Tyler Johnson spotted Palat, slipped a pass by Bogosian. Palat goes shelf on Pavlik for his second of the night, and it's 4-1 Lightning with their largest lead of the evening.
This one happened right off the faceoff at center ice. Yep. So this one sort of just came out of nowhere, and there was a litany of errors on this one, Richard.
There were. I thought the pass by Kucherov to Johnson was a beautiful pass. Again, Kucherov was very impressive last night. Johnson coming with speed. I thought Johnson played a really nice game. And then Palat scoring. He played a nice game, too. This was a very effective. Those three players were very effective. But what happens here, guys, is Frolik and Gagliardi are on the draw. They're going to take the wingers there. Lowry kind of daydreams a second and loses Johnson. That's his guy. And Enstrom... You don't know exactly, obviously, the system, exactly what the Jets want to play, but Enstrom comes and kind of pressures Kucherov. And Kucherov makes a beautiful pass, but if Enstrom has the support of Lowry on Johnson there, then the puck gets turned over the neutral zone and the Jets go the other way. But he didn't have that support. There's about 3 strides between Johnson and Lowry, and Lowry's not the best skater in the world. Not the worst skater in the world, but he's not the best skater. Johnson's very fast. And as soon as he lost that gap, Johnson picks up the puck off that tip pass and goes in on a 2-on-1 and makes a nice pass to Palat. So, it's one of those things where, again, it's decisions, it's execution, it's preventable mistakes, it's knowing who you're playing against and the transition speed of Tampa Bay, right? And that's what happens.
Ezzy, a bit of a rough game for Adam Lowry last night, but not to be unexpected given that he's a rookie center in the NHL, playing his seventh game.
Yeah.
Right. You can't be too hard on Adam Lowry. I really like Adam Lowry's game, and I think he has shown that he can be an everyday NHLer, and that's why they decided to start Adam Lowry in the NHL as opposed to sending him back to the St. John's Ice Caps of the AHL. But
you know, they started him off at wing, and there's a lot more pressure at center. This is just showing you. I'm not trying to point him out. I'm not trying to say, oh, this is the guy who caused all the problems. But the idea is when guys are brought in as centers, as wingers, like Sagan's, like different guys like that, there's less pressure on them because defensively you have so much less of a responsibility. I thought that was certainly demonstrated last night.
You talk to anybody who knows anything about hockey, center's the hardest position.
And for forward,
goaltenders, obviously, pretty hard too. I don't want to take anything. Let's say aside from goaltender, the center ice position, at the very least, every position has its own you know, nuances, but the center ice position, you have the most responsibility. You have to cover the most ice.
That's right.
And I agree. And, you know, Adam Lowry playing against the Tampa Bay Lightning, the team that I think can win the Stanley Cup this year. I think they have that much skill. He had a rough game, you know, on the Jonathan Drouin goal. He doesn't pick up Jonathan Drouin. And on that goal, you know, off the faceoff with Tyler Johnson, he doesn't pick up the streaking forward. It was a tough game. We don't want to pick on Adam Lowry. But, you know, again, when he's been moved from wing to center, which is his natural position, but when he started the year at wing and, you know, it was a rough game for him. And I think he'll bounce back. He'll be all right.
The Jets made it 4-2 at the 10:19 mark of the third period. It was a little bit of window dressing, though, but it was a good effort from Blake Wheeler in that he really sort of willed his way into this goal that made it that gave the Jets a little bit of life for the last 10 minutes of the game.
You know, he did, Drew. Yeah.
Feeds it up along the wing for Perreault in toward the middle for Little. Now on the far side for Bogosian. He lets a shot go as he got across the line, kicked away by Bishop. 4-1 Tampa Bay. Perreault tried to move it out in front and did to Wheeler. Let a shot go. Stopped by Bishop. Center back out in front. They're banging away at it. Wheeler turns. Lets a shot go. He scores!
Sorry, you know, this is just, as you mentioned before, a will goal. Like, he wants that puck at the scrum. He gets the puck. He turns around. He flips it on net. Bishop doesn't see it, and I thought that was a really nice effort from Wheeler. And I know it was, you know, he said window dressing, it's late, but that's still a game at the 10:19 mark of the third period. You still want to see the effort, and I thought it was nice to see the effort. Wheeler's been fighting it a bit here lately. I think if you're a Jets fan, you have to hope that'll get him off the schneid and, you know, get him a little more confidence.
Yeah, it was a sand wedge.
It was a little bit of a but a little bit of a lob wedge there. You're absolutely right. Jets lose 4-2 to the Tampa Bay Lightning. They'll be next in action tomorrow afternoon against the Colorado Avalanche. When we come back, we'll start our discussion on that game. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN 1290.ca.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290, online TSN1290.ca. Coming up in a couple of minutes, Drew Spivak of ESPNDenver.com is going to join us, talk about the Jets-Avs game. Stay tuned. After Saturday Spotlight, we're going to go through the Winnipeg Jets roster. And with apologies to Bill Simmons and his annual NBA trade value rankings, we're going to do the same thing for the Winnipeg Jets. So you can look forward to that in the second hour of the program today. But Richard,
hold on a second. Richie, are you googling cheese sauce right now?
Yeah, I might make some a little dip for tonight.
I'm over here
watching. Richard's birthday, by the way, is now going to last 4 days.
I'm here watching the highlights of the Avalanche Canucks game on my laptop. I look over, Richie's googling cheese sauce.
There was an escapade this morning. Is that what I understand?
Yeah, there was an escapade this morning as he was kind enough to pick me up this morning. And in fact, he was on time.
That in and of itself is shocking.
Shocking enough. And so as I'm waiting on the stairs, I am on the phone with a friend of ours. And I say, you know, I got to go. Ezzy's here to pick me up. So I walk into the car and Ezzy's like, oh, who are you talking to? I was like, oh, you know, I'm talking to our friend Josh. He's like, oh, cool, cool. And so I hang up the phone and then I put the phone into Ezzy's, like, case where I guess below the CD player, like
drink console.
I still have a CD player.
Yeah, drink console, whatever it is. At the
my
front.
Car is that old, but I still
console.
Have a CD player.
Center console. And then Ezzy looks down and goes, oh, did you leave your phone in my car last night?
I just wasn't thinking.
I was like, but I just walked into the car on the phone. We talked about who I was talking to, and then I placed the phone down in the center console. How could I have left the phone in the car last night?
Let's just say that it was a late night last night,
And we're thankful the show's at noon and not at 9 a.m. or something along those lines.
Yeah.
The decisions are made, Drew, based upon what time the show is at.
Well, that's good. That's borderline responsible in its own sort of weird way.
Fair enough.
You know, you determine how drunk you're going to get based on what time you have to be awake.
This morning was like one of those mornings where like you go to put coffee in the coffee maker and then like you turn it on and then you go shower and then you come back and realize you didn't put water in the coffee maker. That was like one of those mornings like that.
That's probably every morning in your life. Let's go to break. When we come back, Drew Spivak, ESPNDenver.com, talk about the Jets and the Avs tomorrow. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
.41 saves tonight. He's made some great ones, too. He's given up six goals. Out to the point, long shot. Score! Jerome Iginla with a redirect. Unbelievable, the long blast from the left point. Iginla just cruising by the front of the net as Tanguay let it fly. He sneaks it inside the far post for his second of the game. He moves past Mike Modano all by himself for 23rd of the all-time goal-scoring list. He's got 562.
Colorado Avalanche last night, victors over the Vancouver Canucks. And to talk about it, we bring in on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
From ESPNDenver.com, we're pleased to welcome Drew Spivak back to the program. Drew, good afternoon, and thanks for joining us.
Hey, absolutely, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Drew, Avalanche broke out of the sort of doldrums to start the season, scoring seven last night. Do you think that's a one-time occurrence, or do you think that this is the start of them emerging from their slumber?
Well, I think it can kind of be looked at a couple different ways. I mean, it's nice to see that this team was finally able to take advantage of the multiple scoring chances that they've been getting early on in the season, and to get out and get seven goals last night was a really good sign. So you'd like to think that it's hopefully a sign of things to come. Now, obviously, they're not going to go out and score seven goals every single night, but if they can go out and kind of produce off that and build off that a little bit, that's definitely going to be something nice to see. But you kind of have to look at it from the other perspective and say, well, you know, Vancouver came into town last night, the second game of a back-to-back. They got their backup goaltender in goal. So they were kind of just, you know, they weren't the same Vancouver team that you would probably normally see, although obviously Vancouver's not a great team, but still a little bit better than the effort that they put forth last night. But it's definitely a good sign for the Avalanche to kind of get that broken out. And it's something this team really needed badly, because they've been struggling so much to score goals this year. They've had multiple chances with it. And to see guys like Jerome Iginla kind of get going and Matt Duchene really get it going, it's definitely a positive sign for this team.
Drew, Patrick Waugh had the perfect year last year in the sense that the Avalanche won the division. He wins the Jack Adams Award. Now that it's his second season, how is he handling these early season struggles?
You know, it seems like it's starting to get to him a little bit. At least we saw after Tuesday night's game, it was kind of the first time that he really was negative about his team and kind of called his team out a little bit, just saying that, you know, that they didn't want it bad enough, that they weren't trying hard enough. They thought everything was going to come easy to them this year, and they weren't going to have to work as hard as they did last year. And it was kind of good to see him actually come out and say that instead of being, you know, kind of his normal positive type self. But, you know, he seems like he's handling everything okay with it. I think it would be nice to see him make a few more adjustments defensively to kind of help out his goaltenders a little bit, because, you know, I'm sure as you guys have seen that this team is, I don't want to say they're worse than last year, but I think it's a little bit more obvious this year, maybe with the lack of scoring, that this team has a lot of defensive issues that they need to get worked on. And obviously it's hard to change the roster now that you're into the beginning of the season. But, you know, it'd be good to see Patrick Waugh go out there and make some adjustments and make this team a little bit better defensively. But, you know, we'll kind of wait and see how that happens. He made a change last night as far as the lineup goes, putting Zach Redmond in for the first time on defense. He had a pretty nice game last night. So hopefully he'll kind of stick around and get things going. He's a nice little puck-moving defenseman. But, you know, it'll be interesting to see if he can kind of make some adjustments moving forward to kind of help out his team and get this thing going on the right end.
Drew, you're trying to get the Jets fans going here saying that Redmond had a good game last night.
I know. Well, it's funny because we've been clamoring for him. All of us in the media here and a lot of the fans have been saying, you know, we got this hashtag on Twitter, the hashtag Free Rettman, because he had such a good training camp for the Avalanche. He played really well in the preseason, and it was kind of a shock to everybody that he wasn't in the lineup to start the year, because he kind of seems like the perfect guy to fit in this offense, right? You know, or fit with this team both offensively and defensively, and it was just a big shocker that he wasn't getting an opportunity before this.
How good of a job did the scoreboard operator do last night?
You know, it seemed like he did a pretty decent job, better than the one at Mile High Stadium, apparently. There was nobody to call out the scoreboard operator, so that was definitely a good thing.
Nathan MacKinnon, Drew, is obviously, you know, is a tremendous talent. He only has 4 points, 4 assists through 8 games, and doesn't have any goals, obviously, which is shocking to most. What's been his biggest issue through these first 8 games, and you know, how soon do you see him breaking out of this?
You know, it kind of seems like he's struggling with his confidence a little bit. He's fighting the puck a lot. He doesn't seem to know exactly kind of where to go with the puck at times and kind of, you know, how to play it. And, you know, it was kind of a weird transition to start the year because Patrick Watt said he was going to start him out at center, which is his natural position, and have him kind of begin the season there playing with Gabriel Landeskog, and then Jerome Iginla, I think, is how he started the season. And then, you know, he kind of got off to a slow start, didn't really do much, and then Patrick Waugh moved him back to the wing position where he played most of last season, and kind of thinking that was going to break him out of his slump a little bit, and it really hasn't. So it kind of makes you wonder a little bit if he's really missing Paul Stastny, because MacKinnon played with Stastny for most of the season last year, and Stastny did a great job of putting MacKinnon in positions to succeed, and we haven't seen that so far this year. But I think, you know, obviously this kid is a tremendous talent. He's going to break out of it at some point, and you know, I don't want to necessarily say it's a sophomore slump for him, but it's definitely tough to see him get off to such a slow start. But you kind of remember they did start pretty slowly last year. I think he only had 3 goals in his first 23 games or something like that. So, you know, it's something that the Avs are definitely going to need him to start stepping up and kind of be the player that we thought he was going to turn into this year, given all the size and skill that he's improved on even more in the offseason and in the training camp and stuff. But he definitely needs to get it going for this team to be successful.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. Our guest is Drew Spivak from ESPNDenver.com, talking about the Avalanche ahead of their game tomorrow afternoon here in Winnipeg. Drew, last night, like we said, is sort of a coming out party for most of the Avalanche. Jerome Iginla gets his first 2 goals of the year as part of a 3-goal night. Aside from sort of the struggles in putting the puck in the back of the net to start the season,
3-point night.
Pardon me?
3-point now, you mean?
Sorry, three-point now. Yes, exactly. How has he been fitting in the Avalanche lineup?
He's been great. You know, everybody's really happy to have him in there. He's kind of brought that veteran-type presence in there and kind of a calming influence, because the way that this team started out the season, things could have really spiraled downhill fast, you know, if you not had a guy like Iginla in there to kind of calm everything down and let everybody know, hey, this thing's going to be all right. It's a long season. We got a long ways to go. But he's been great both on and off the ice. You look at, you know, obviously he hasn't gotten on the score sheet as far as goals go up until last night, but he was leading the team in assists. In fact, I think he's got 5 assists on the season now. So he's doing things to help this team out. And you know the goals are going to come with him. He's one of those guys that usually gets off to a slower start anyway, and then once he gets hot, he's tough to slow down. So it's definitely been a good thing for him and a good sign. And starting to build a chemistry, playing with Matt Duchene now and getting that chemistry going with him and playing with Alex Tanguay, a guy he played with back in his days in Calgary, that's definitely going to be a good sign for them. But I think it's just once you get this chemistry going with this team and you know, kind of get familiar with playing with Matt Duchene, learn what he likes to do and things like that, I think he's only going to improve. And I think he's going to have another tremendous season.
Drew, you mentioned Zach Redmond, of course, ex-Winnipeg Jet, and he made his NHL debut, season debut, I should say, yesterday for the Colorado Avalanche and picked up an assist. When you look at this defense, you know, Brad Stewart is brought in from the San Jose Sharks. He adds that veteran presence, that physical defensive presence. But as you know, the Avalanche at times have trouble moving the puck out of their own zone. When you look at this D group, do you think Joe Sakic's going to have to make a move and maybe bring in a puck-moving defenseman as the season progresses?
I really do. Yeah, I think that's going to be a definite area of need. There were a lot of concerns, I think, going into the season that Brad Stewart wasn't necessarily going to be the great signing. And unfortunately, so far, he's kind of proven that. He hasn't been very good in this lineup at all. I think he's had maybe one good game where he didn't stand out as a defensive liability. But that's kind of what he looks like back there on the defensive end right now. He looks like he's slow to the puck. He's not quite sure what to do with it. He makes a lot of bad turnovers, a lot of really bad decisions, and it's not something that this Avalanche team can afford, because, as you guys know, this defense has got a lot of holes in it. And I think one of the biggest holes when you look at this defense is the fact that they don't really have a top-quality defenseman to pair in that top group with Eric Johnson, because Eric Johnson's guy is having a really good year so far, but whoever he's been paired with, and so far it's, this year it's been Jan Hayda or Nick Holden, the two of the left-handed shot defensemen, the Avalanche don't really have a lot of depth in that area. So you got guys in Hayda and Holden that are really playing in roles that they probably shouldn't be playing in, and it's really cost this team so far. So I think Sackett's going to have to go out and make some sort of a move and bring in, you know, some sort of a top four defenseman. But the problem is going to be, well, who's available out there, and at what price is it going to cost you? Is it going to cost you a Ryan O'Reilly, a Matt Duchene, somebody like that? It's kind of a worrisome thing. So you kind of worry that they might be stuck with what they've got right now, and then they're just going to have to hope that these guys improve and then maybe see if they can go out and do something in the offseason to improve this defense.
Drew, you know, coming into the year, people were skeptical of the Avalanche in terms of the numbers, and they weren't that favorable to Colorado. And there, you know, some thought they might have been a bit of the performance was a bit of an anomaly last year. I'm sure management was aware of it. Were the players aware of it? And if so, you know, what are their thoughts on that? And how do they? Does that change at all their approach this year?
Yeah, I mean, I think the players were all aware of it. They didn't want to go, you know, specifically into kind of the Corsi and the Fenway Tech numbers and things like that. But, you know, they all realized that they needed to be a better puck possession team than they were last year, because really this team was dominated as far as puck possession goes up until probably the last 5 or 6 minutes of each period. And that's when you saw so many times last year that they would control the play late in the games and be able to make the miraculous comebacks that they did so many times last year. But they all realize it. But they know too that they've all got to be better, you know, kind of at both ends of the ice, and they can't get outshot every night. And I think one of the things that we've seen so far this year with the offense struggling like it has at the beginning of the season, it's kind of highlighted the inefficiencies of this team and the lack of good defensive talent, something that we didn't see last year because this team really didn't go through many scoring droughts. So while you knew the defense was bad, you didn't realize it was as bad as it actually is because they were scoring so many goals per game. But, you know, I think they're going to get this thing turned around and get it better and start scoring, you know, 3, 4, 5 goals every single night. And they're going to have to do that. But they, at the end of the day, they've got to be better defensively. They can't let Semyon Varlamov sit there and get peppered, you know, 35, 40 shots every single night and expect to do the things that they did in that Central Division last year, because you guys know this division is absolutely mm-hmm. brutal. Every team in this division, I think, has improved. Even the Jets, you know, we obviously don't know how much improved the Jets are yet, but look at what Nashville's doing. Look at what Chicago's doing already to start the season. And Dallas and Minnesota are still really good teams. And so it's a difficult climb, but they're going to have to be better, and they have to outshoot teams every night and not give Varlamov peppered every game.
45 minutes past the hour, you're listening to TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. We're joined on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show by Drew Spivak of ESPNDenver.com.
Drew, Danny Briere acquired right before the free agent frenzy there in late June, acquired for P.A. Parenteau. He's played in all 8 games, picked up a couple goals. How's he fit into the team so far?
You know, he's been pretty good. The nice thing with Danny Briere, you know, as opposed to having a guy like P.A. Parenteau, which they had last year, is that he's a little bit more versatile. He can do a few more things. You can put him either at center or on the wing and have him be kind of set up for success. You can move him between the third line and the fourth line. And then, you know, if necessary, you can put him up and probably have him playing on that second line. But so far, he's been a pretty nice fit out there. And, you know, he'll probably get things going. I think the kind of the surprise thing is that they don't have him playing on the power play. I kind of expect him to get some power play time with this team. But when you've got as much talent as the Avalanche do offensively, and a lot of these guys that can play a lot of big power play minutes, it's tough for a guy like Briere to get in there. But he's been really good, and especially on the penalty kill, he's been really solid playing that kind of a role. And this team has been really good on the penalty kill all season long, and he's definitely been a big part of it.
Final question here, Drew. The Avalanche shook up their scouting staff this past week. They fired Rick Pracy, who was their director of amateur scouting. What was the story behind that firing?
You know what? We don't know. Honestly, the Avalanche have been really tight-lipped about it. I think there was a little bit of possible, I don't want to say concern, but kind of a little bit of a disagreement last year as far as, when they took Nathan MacKinnon, I think they were really looking at Drouin and Barkov and guys like that as opposed to taking MacKinnon last year. And I don't know if it was some sort of an internal disagreement between Patrick Waugh and Rick Tracy as far as kind of what the direction was they wanted to go. But it's really hard to say exactly what happened with it right now. We asked Patrick Waugh earlier this week in a kind of a media session with him what the deal was, and he basically said, you know, I'm not going to comment on that. I'll let you guys ask Joe Sakic and you know, we haven't been able to talk to Joe Sakic about it, and the team never put out a press release kind of saying what happened. But as far as we know, they parted ways, and kind of what it seems like is it doesn't really sound like it was an amicable split. But, yeah, it's hard to say, and it just seems like it's kind of a bad time to be doing that kind of early in the season when you're starting to scout for next year's draft. I mean, obviously there's no real good time to get rid of your director of amateur scouting, but it's tough to lose a guy like Krejci because you look at the guys that he's brought in the last couple of years in Duchesne and Landeskog and obviously McKinnon. He's had some really good drafts for this team, and it's tough to see him go. So hopefully they can get this correct and bring the right guy in to replace him.
Drew Spivak covers the Colorado Avalanche for ESPNDenver.com. Drew, appreciate you doing this. Thanks very much.
Hey, anytime, guys. Thanks for having me.
We'll talk to you soon. Let's head to break. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Centering pass hit a leg. Picked up by EJ. Jams it ahead. Habs have a 2-on-1. Duchesne with the Gidla. Duchesne on a breakaway. In shoots and scores. Matt Duchesne. The breakaway goal. And the Habs have taken a commanding 5-2 lead over the Vancouver Canucks. As he got up and he got on it like a son of a gun. He had a 2-on-1 with the Gidla. He kept it himself. Got the breakaway. Slides it underneath Eddie Lack. And you know I'm all about that bass.
That's a great line there at the end by Mark Moser on the Avs Radio Network. The Avalanche and the Jets tomorrow afternoon at MTS Center. The Jets look to end the homestand on a positive note, but they're facing a team in the Colorado Avalanche that, you know, had struggled to start the year. They're not a great record to start after last night's victory. They're now 2-4-2 for 6 points in 8 games. 2 points better than the Winnipeg Jets. But anytime a team breaks out of a sort of a scoring slump by getting 7 goals, it's something to be concerned about. Then again, the Avs given up 27 goals so far this season on the flip side.
Yeah, they've had some trouble keeping the puck out of their own net, Drew. 7 goals last night versus the Vancouver Canucks. Iggy had 2-6 different goal scorers, though. So as we know, this team is not a one-line team. It wasn't a one-line team last year. And I like the moves they've made. And I don't think, by the way, Richie, that it's necessarily bad that the Colorado Avalanche finished worse than they did last year. I feel like there was almost raised expectations for how they would do in the playoffs. I didn't think the Colorado Avalanche, I must admit, I didn't think the Colorado Avalanche were going to do anywhere near as well as they did last year in the regular season. But I thought that come playoff time, when you play the better teams in the Western Conference, the more established teams. But this Colorado Avalanche team, regardless of who they end up moving around, because sometimes they'll use Ryan O'Reilly with Duchesne and Tanguay, but because of Iggy's familiarity with Tanguay and Calgary, they've been going with Iggy and Tanguay flanking Duchesne and then McKinnon, Landeskog, and O'Reilly on that top line. But there's lots of depth throughout the lineup. I really like Jamie McGinn on that third line. He scored last night. He's been a guy who's been with the Avalanche for several years now, but this is an Avalanche team, again, similar type of game to the Tampa Bay Lightning. They still aren't playing, I think, the type of possession game that they want. And, you know, Drew Spivak, who we just had on, mentioned, you know, a guy like Brad Stewart, you know, is a big Brad Stewart fan, great defenseman, Richie, over the years with the Wings and the Sharks, but he's lost a step. And he's not the same defenseman. So look at this Avalanche team, and, you know, the Jets, do they have a chance? Absolutely. But, you know, if you fall asleep for a couple plays like they did against the Lightning, this team can, you know, put 2 goals in the net very quickly.
Yeah, I mean, they're top heavy. Their talent level is high, and they have a good problem. They have to fill out their bottom end of their forwards over time. And, well, obviously their defense they need to address, but, you know, their goaltending is pretty solid. So, you know, I think long term the Avs are in a good position. You talk about puck possession and all that stuff. Well, over time, I think this team will be fine. I don't really have any concerns about that. You know, based on this year and next year, can they beat anybody? I think they can beat anybody, but I also think they can lose to anybody. I don't, you know, they certainly can be exposed. But at the same time, I mean, if you look at last year against the Wild, if they don't lose Tyson Barrie, they probably win the series. So, you know, it goes both ways, guys. You have to be able to handle the speed of this team. Duchesne and McKinnon can do such amazing things at full speed. Like, I mean, a lot of players can't do the things that they can do, and they need to slow down to be able to execute. McKinnon and Duchesne can be going as fast as they possibly can and be stick handling and making moves and making a pass and shooting at that top level, and very few players can do that. So you have to be able to, in transition, as you mentioned, it's Tampa. May not have the depth of Tampa, but the transition game, as we saw, as you saw the fourth goal yesterday, pass, 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 goal. That's what Colorado can do to you off the rush. You really have to be aware of that. So they're going to be dangerous. You know, coming off seven goals, they're going to feel more confident. The Jets are certainly not feeling confident right now. So, you know, how do you deal with matchups? And how do you deal with matchups? Well, this is the problem you have. You have two loaded lines, and the Jets don't really have two pairings who can shut you down. It's going to be it's a tough test for the Jets.
Flipping it around, how do the Jets take advantage of the Colorado Avalanche? We've talked about their defense. It's nothing to really write home about.
Well, you look at the left side. I mean, you're looking at not the fastest left side, so you're looking at taking advantage of a speed game. The Jets need to be able to play faster. They're a fast team that's not playing fast right now, though.
The left side being Nick Holden on, and Jan Hayda and Brad Stewart.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, you can take advantage of that defense for sure. And you know what I mean by that is putting the puck, either skating it through the zone or putting it into those guys' corners and either getting there first or chasing them and putting pressure on them to make turnovers. That's one of the big things you can do with this Avs team. You know, you want to make these guys defend too, and it may mean, you know, so the Jets don't necessarily play much of a cycle game down low and keeping the puck in deep. So it's not a great matchup for the Jets. Like this is not the best matchup, and the skill level is so high for Colorado that the Jets just can't match it. So they're going to have to use. You look at this game 2-5 now. The Jets are and the way they're kind of out of sorts right now, and Colorado coming in. Colorado's a little bit desperate too, guys. That's another thing to take into account. Like they won yesterday, but they don't feel like they're there yet. Waugh's been leaning on them pretty hard. And kind of lost it, as Drew Spivak mentioned last segment, on the team this past week. So, you know, I don't know if Maurice will lose it on the Jets coming up here, or if that'll make a difference. But it's a tough task to play against this squad. And it's a tough task to be able to match up. And the Jets just don't have the defensemen to match up against these teams right now. Like, they play against the top teams, and they don't have they can't match up. I mean, how are you going to do it? What are you going to do against, you know, Tampa, even like their second, third, fourth, they have very good depth to the roster. But when you're talking about top-heavy teams, whether you consider San Jose top-heavy, I think they're a little bit top-heavy, and certain other teams that the Jets have played, they just what do you do? You're calling on Mark Stewart and Jacob Trouba. You can't call on Mark Stewart in the top four every night. And again, this is not a Paul Maurice problem because Paul Maurice doesn't have any alternatives. This is a personnel problem. This is a management problem. They haven't addressed the holes that they've been there for a consistent amount of time. So what do? You either address it through trade by getting a defenseman to play in the top four. You possibly move Byfuglien back. Then you have to address it by getting a forward. Or you look at, and we're going to talk about this, I guess, leading into later on the show, trading a bunch of these guys. And starting it, which I think is the best option it has been for some time, and redoing this, kind of starting over. Because the problems we're talking about now are the same problems we talked about last year in October, and are very much the same problems we talked about the October prior to that. And at some point, that's got to change. So I could go on and on about this right now, but I know we have Saturday Spotlight coming up, so we'll leave it there, and why don't we come back and talk about the trade value after.
Okay, we'll talk about the trade value after Saturday Spotlight. Before we go to break, from Winnipeg Jets the skate today, Andre Pavlik first off the ice, so it does appear the Jets will go back with Pavlik between the net for against Colorado tomorrow.
4 one-timer goals last night, and I don't think Maurice really trusts Hutchinson that much. Personally, I don't think he does. So they're going to ride Pavlik, and
we'll see.
Yeah.
Let's go to break. When we come back, Saturday Spotlight with Andy Murray. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
One hour down, 2 hours to go. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290, online at tsn1290.ca. Follow us on Twitter at IllegalCurve, facebook.com/IllegalCurve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and NHL news. And in case you missed the video of last night's moment of silence and O Canada, it is available on IllegalCurve.com. You can check it out there. Dave Minuk doing a great job, of course, on the website. It's time for Saturday Spotlight.
The Illegal Curve, Saturday Spotlight.
Earlier this week, I had the opportunity to sit down with current Western Michigan University head coach Andy Murray, of course, better known to people around these parts, both as the former assistant coach of the Winnipeg Jets 1.0, the former head coach of the St. Louis Blues and the Los Angeles Kings, and the former multiple-time head coach of Team Canada on the international scene. Here's that interview with Andy Murray.
Andy, I want to take you back to the 1970s, specifically the Brandon Olympics of the old CSHL, the Central Senior Hockey League. That's where your playing career came to an end. When did you know that you weren't going to make it as a hockey player and you had to take a different avenue?
I don't think you ever believe that you won't make it as a hockey player. You just move to a different league and a slower league and whatever it takes. So I think all the guys that are playing old-timers still love playing the game. But, you know, to me, actually coaching was something that I really never gave a great deal of thought to. And my uncle asked me to get involved with the Wheat Kings organization. He was one of the owners to coach their team in the Manitoba Junior League. And they had wanted to replace their present coach. And I came in never having coached before, and all of a sudden I was a hockey coach. So I apologize to all those players that played for me in those early years, but it was a lot of fun, and I enjoyed it. I learned a great deal, obviously.
Well, that leads me to my next question, and if my research is correct, your first coaching job was with the Brandon Travelers. Is that right?
Yeah, you know, it was. They were a team in the Manitoba Junior Hockey League at that time, and were basically an affiliate team of the Wheat Kings, and you know, a lot of great players came through our team and went on to play for the Wheat Kings, and obviously a number of them went on to play in the National Hockey League as well, too. So it was a well-run program, and the Wheat Kings still have a great organization, and at that time they felt they needed their own affiliate team, so they ran a team in the Manitoba Junior Hockey League.
And then after your time with the Travelers and the Wheat Kings, it was off to Brandon University to be a Bobcat, the head coach of the Brandon Bobcats. What was the Canadian college game like at that point?
Well, you know, I think it's the Canadian college game is still a great game. I think it's one of the most underestimated levels of hockey that we have here in North America. And it's a great product and a great game. And, I had the good fortune to coach a lot of great players there. And with that came a degree of success that allowed me to get opportunities down the road in coaching. So it's a high level of hockey at the university. And at that time, we had good players and good teams in Brandon and some great rivalries with University of Manitoba, and at that time the University of Winnipeg had a college program as well too, it was quality hockey, good players, and certainly they took it very seriously, as they do now.
After your time in Brandon, you decided it was time to sort of expand your horizons, and you know, you were sort of unique in that you went overseas at that point. Nowadays, you know, we hear about it all the time. There's lots of coaches, former NHL coaches, who go overseas. Mike Keenan comes to mind, of course. And you're now, so you headed overseas. What made you make that decision at that point?
Well, you know, there were some professional opportunities over here that had come up, and you know, at that time, we in the early 80s, we were learning a great deal from exposure to the European teams coming over, and we obviously had a lot of great games against the Russians and so on when they came over. So, and I just felt to expand my horizons as a coach and to learn something different, that it might be a good way to go. So I went over there with the idea of going on a one-year leave of absence from Brandon University, and ended up staying 8 years. So it was a great experience, being able to learn other languages and to, you know, experience a different culture. The hockey part was real good, but more than anything else, it was just a lifetime experience that affords you in doing that. So I think it made me a better coach. I was over there in a country where I didn't speak the language and had to somehow get the message across, and really enjoyed it. And I think it really helped me in terms of helping establish a foundation in coaching.
Do you find your experiences over in Europe, you still sort of harken back on them when you talk about teaching a new group of hockey players in this day and age?
I think in Europe there, I mean, you're there by yourself. The GM of the pro teams and so on, they leave you alone, and you're responsible for recruiting players and doing everything. So much similar to what I'm doing here now at the Division I level in the U.S. But no, it was a great experience, and seeing how other coaches conducting themselves, the way they played over there, and trying to take the best from their game and then integrate some of the things that make us truly unique here in North America. So it was a great experience for myself and our family.
You said you came back after 8 years in Europe, if I recall correctly, and what brought you back is a job with the Hershey Bears in the AHL. How did that come to be?
Well, John Paddock was a friend for a number of years from southwestern Manitoba. I'm from Souris, Manitoba, and John was from Oak River. So we had a relationship, and John used to skate. I ran a camp for pro players in the summer when John was playing pro hockey in the Flyers organization for the Flyers. He used to skate in the summers, and we developed a relationship there. And he asked me at the end of my seasons in Switzerland if I would come over and help him out in Hershey. So I came over 2 years in a row once my season was done in Switzerland and helped out with the Hershey Bears. And we were fortunate enough that John took them to the Calder Cup Championship the 1 year. And the next year, Philadelphia Flyers were looking for an assistant coach, and I got to meet Bob Clark and Paul Holmgren through that experience in Hershey. And Bob asked me if I'd be interested in coming back. So I came back and joined the Flyers organization. It was certainly the exposure in Hershey that allowed that to happen as well.
You mentioned Paul Holmgren. He was, of course, the head coach of that Flyers team. And one of your fellow assistant coaches is a current competitor of yours in the NCAA. That's Mike Eaves. What did you learn from both Paul Holmgren and Mike Eaves? And are you still in touch with both of them?
Yes, I am. I mean, Mike is, our families became close friends, and his sons and my sons have played together on various teams and at World Junior Tournament and so on. So there's a relationship there. And Paul, we certainly, whenever he's in town scouting players or evaluating players, we have a chance to interact there. So, whoever you work with in this business, you try to absorb as much as you possibly can and share information, and it was a great experience. I mean, Paul was obviously an intimidating physical player who just played with so much passion, and Mike was a skilled player, as a player in the National Hockey League, and had a unique perspective on the game as well, and does a tremendous job at the University of Wisconsin. And actually, one of my sons went and played for Mike at Wisconsin. We had that kind of a relationship.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. Our guest is Andy Murray, currently head coach of the Western Michigan Broncos of the NCAA, talking about his career in hockey. Andy, after your time in Philly, you started heading a little bit north, not too far from Winnipeg. You went to Minnesota under Bob Gainey. Bob Gainey was over there as well. What can you tell our listeners about Bob Gainey as a coach and as a person?
Well, I went from Philadelphia to Minnesota. Bob Clark went from the Flyers organization to Minnesota and asked me if I would come and join him as one of the coaches there. And, I had the good fortune to work with Bob Gainey and Doug Jarvis, two icons in the Montreal Canadiens organization during their playing days. And, Bob he was a solid, honest, highly competitive player, and he was the same thing as a head coach and a GM, and treats everybody with respect, and expects people to do the right thing all the time, whether it's on the ice or off the ice. So learned a great deal from Bob and certainly from Doug. And Bob's style was one where he was pretty black and white, and had a thorough understanding of the game and the way that it should operate. And I can remember being in many meetings, and we have different coaches and scouts, and they'd be all throwing a whole bunch of different ideas out as to what could help our team and what we needed to do, and have all these complicated theories and everything like that. And Bob would simply say, well, why don't we do it this way? And it would be pretty basic, but it was usually the right answer. So, he was an honest player, and that's the way he operated as a coach and a GM.
Andy Murray is our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. You mentioned John Paddock. We've talked about Bobby Clark. Sort of the Philadelphia to Winnipeg ties are well documented, and they came full circle when you eventually returned to Winnipeg as the assistant coach under John Paddock for the Jets for two seasons. What did that mean to you coming home? You mentioned you're from Souris, Manitoba. What did that mean to you coming to coach for the Winnipeg Jets?
Well, I think growing up in Manitoba, you always identify with hockey in the province, and it was a special opportunity for me to come up and for my family to come back to Manitoba and to be in Winnipeg and renew acquaintances and also meet so many other quality Manitobans. So I really enjoyed it, enjoyed working with John there, and certainly to build a coach in one's home province and be close to service and my friends in the Westman area. It was great having my friends bring their kids into practices and been able to walk through the dressing room on a regular basis. I hadn't really been able to do much of that in Philadelphia and Minnesota, so it was kind of neat to share that experience. And there's nothing better or more gratifying in a job in the National Hockey League that when you bring a young boy into the dressing room and you look at their eyes as they're walking around and they're seeing the names of the Solani and Tkachuk and all these guys, and they're sitting down getting their picture taken in a stall. That probably made me feel as good about the profession as anything else that I ever did in the game.
Andy Murray's our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. You're listening to TSN 1290. Andy, you finally got the chance for the first time since your days with the Brandon Travelers to be a head coach, and that's with the Los Angeles Kings. What was the biggest difference between being a head man and an assistant?
Well, not to correct you, but I was a head coach in Switzerland.
I apologize. I meant in North America.
For 8 years, and then I was a head coach in Switzerland in the Spangler Cups. I coached Team Canada.
Oh yeah,
and actually coached Team Canada World Championships as a head coach there before I.
We're gonna get to your international career. That's a long lengthy one as well.
Yeah. Well, it's amazing. You've got all these stats. Because I thought it was only going to be about 20 minutes. You're going to need about an hour and a half there. Certainly the international game and having the chance to coach Canada, it doesn't get any better than that. But the chance to coach the LA Kings, and I'd coached Rob Blake and Glenn Murray and a number of other players on the LA Kings during my time with Team Canada at World Championships. So, when the Kings offered the opportunity, it was exciting to have that chance. And, I think probably the best day as a National Hockey League is the day when they tell you that they'd like to have you and you get that opportunity to be a coach. It's really special. But, other than that, coaching the NHL is just the same as coaching any other team at any other level. You just try to communicate with your players. You set expectations and you try to be demanding but not demeaning with your players. And, you just push them as much as you can because, the saying that, you want the best from them because it's the best for them. So, I thoroughly enjoyed my opportunity in L.A. and was a long-tenured coach there, spent a lot of years there and really enjoyed it.
You mentioned your international career, and we have to talk about that because it's probably the most extensive or one of the most extensive coaching careers internationally in the world. 3 world championships, many Spangler Cup championships. You've coached in the Olympics. You're in the IIHF Hall of Fame. Sort of a two-part question. What's your favorite part of the international game, and what's your most memorable international moment?
Well, they're one and the same. It would be, you kind of get emotional when you even think about it, but when you're representing your country in a competition, and whether it's at a world championship in Finland where we won twice, or in Moscow in 2007 when we won the last gold medal, just seeing the players celebrating on the blue line and singing the national anthem, and then the ability to call my mother while I was on the ice and the players were celebrating, and just to share that with her and thinking about, how proud she was of that moment and how it made her feel, and everybody back in Syracuse there, that was the best moment. Thinking my dad was a passionate hockey person, and just think what it would mean to him to be part of that experience. I just felt so lucky, and, I know there's so many other people that could have been doing and have done what I did, and I was very, very grateful for the opportunity. And whenever I coached at any level, whether it was National Hockey League or with Team Canada or wherever, it was always with the mindset that I got a lot of friends and family back home in Manitoba that I don't want to let down, and for me to have that opportunity was truly unique. So just more than anything, it's when somebody's singing your national anthem and you see it being raised up and somebody's putting a gold medal around your neck, it's pretty special.
Having coached both amateurs, you know, at the Olympics and internationally, and having coached pro in the NHL, do you think that the NHL professionals belong in the Olympics, or do you think that they're sort of missing something from when it was a much more amateur Olympic tournament?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm not that old. The guys I coached in the Olympics were NHLers, so I think there's no question about it. Whenever you put that jersey on, it truly means something special. And, you know, at the Olympics or World Championships or even Spangler Cup, those guys are all pros that play in that as well. And, you know, they're not really getting paid to play in it, but what they're getting is the opportunity to wear the jersey, and it's really special. And again, it's the same type of thing. It's, you know, when you're an NHL coach and you've been selected to coach Team Canada at the World Championships at the end of a long NHL season, you know, and you've got a lot of players that could say no or deny the opportunity to go. And I'm sure there's some players that have come up with a lot of different excuses and injuries not to go and represent their country. But, you know, I can remember calling a lot of guys. You call Joe Sakic or you call Rob Blake or guys of that ilk, and you ask them to if they would be interested in coming to play for their country, and they say, I'll be there. That's really a special feeling because you know what these guys have gone through in the regular season and, you know, how tired and fatigued they are, but yet they're prepared to hop in a plane and go halfway across the world to represent their country. So the pros care. They play with a lot of passion. And, you know, everybody's telling me that it must be great to coach college players who play for the fun of it and really are passionate about the game, and as if to say that NHL players aren't. I mean, I've never met an NHL player that didn't want to play as hard as he possibly could, didn't want to, you know, go out there every night and give his best. The problem is with the NHL schedule the way that it is, it's just not possible every night. There isn't a night that an NHL player plays a game where he's not fatigued or he's not banged up in some way. And certainly they're really compensated extremely well for doing what they're doing. But I would never let anybody tell me that NHL players don't care and don't have passion for the game, because they really do.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Our guest is Andy Murray, head coach of the Western Michigan Broncos. And Andy, we got to talk about the Western Michigan Broncos now. You know, how different is the NCAA experience from all your other coaching experiences, NHL, overseas, Olympic, everything else?
You know, it's to be quite honest with you, it's really a time-consuming job. It's 12 months of the year in terms of recruiting, taking care of things academically for your players and so on. So it's really a time-consuming job. It's not just the hockey part. I mean, you're a parent. You're taking care of these kids while their parents aren't there, and so you're concerned about their off-ice activities and how they're performing academically. But it's a high level of hockey. We've been fortunate to have a lot of players go through our system, sign pro contracts. We had 8 of our 9 players 2 years ago graduated, signed pro contracts. And all 4 of our players who graduated last year signed pro contracts. So it's a high level of hockey. We pack our arena up for every game. Our fans line up. Our students line up at about 3:30 for a 7 o'clock game so they can get into them. And they were voted the best student section in college hockey. And when people come to play here at Western, they really get an appreciation for that. So it's been a great experience. I would never, ever say that one level of a game have I enjoyed more than the other, because that would be a discredit and a disservice to the players that have played for me at all the different levels, whether it was in the Manitoba Junior or with Brandon University, Europe or whatever. So I would never, ever compare that. I would just say that, the ability to coach the game and not to have a real job is really unique and special. And I'm very, very fortunate to have had these opportunities. I mean, that somebody would want to hire me for the college level here when there's so many great young coaches out there was gratifying in itself. So I've enjoyed it.
Andy, I'll let you go on this last question. Here in Canada, there's I don't want to say arrogance, but maybe, you know, there's the perception that the Canadian Hockey League is superior to the NCAA. You know, the pipeline seemed to be changing a little bit. A lot more Canadians are taking the NCAA route. You obviously, your kids, in fact, take the NCAA route over Canadian hockey as well. You know, what's the grassroots in the U.S. looking like nowadays with the United States Hockey League and everything like that? Is it really developing and blossoming even more than we know?
Well, I mean, we're still the best hockey nation in the world in Canada. We care about it more than anybody else does. And, you know, it's not about winning all the time. It's about the number of people that are playing the game. We're giving so many kids an opportunity to play the game in Canada and recreational hockey, old-timers hockey, what people are playing now. And it's really special. But, you know, I would never condemn major junior hockey because they do a great job. There's different ways for different players to go, and it's whatever fits the family's need. I don't believe that college coaches should ever condemn major junior hockey, and I don't believe that major junior coaches should condemn college hockey. There's coaches and major juniors say, if you want to be a pro, you got to go the major junior route. Well, take a look at the percentage of guys that make it in major junior hockey ultimately, and to quite honest with you, it's not very high. And, you know, the numbers in college, you know, we've got, I believe, about 36% of the NHL comes from college hockey now. So you can become an NHL player the college route as well and get an education. But both avenues are great. Major juniors are doing a lot better job of developing their players and academically and everything. So it's just whatever fits the situation. But, you know, we got to stay on our toes. I mean, the Americans, they're emphasizing a skill, fast game, and we still got a few people up in Canada that have the perspective that we have to beat everybody up all the time. And, you know, we got to continue to make sure we emphasize the speed element of the game in Canada. But, you know, we've got the biggest emotional well for the game in the world. And I've always believed that when we have to, Canada can dig deeper than anybody else in that emotional well. And we got to continue to emphasize that, but to also continue to emphasize the skill and speed of the game.
Andy Murray is the head coach of the Western Michigan Broncos of the NCAA. He's a multi-time gold medal winner. He's a former NHL head coach. And most importantly, he's a Manitoban from Souris, Manitoba. Andy, thanks very much for doing this. Much appreciated.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me on.
You're listening to The Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Good job there, Drew.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate that. Big thank you to Andy Murray, head coach of Western Michigan University. Obviously, his career in the NHL, well-documented. His career internationally, well-documented. In case you missed any of that interview, any of Saturday Spotlight or any of the previous Saturday Spotlights with Paul Edmonds or Marty Biron, they're all available on our website, illegalcurve.com. They're all available via iTunes as well, so you can just search for the show, download it, get it sent to you each and every week. While you're at it, follow us on Twitter, at Illegal Curve. Facebook.com/Illegal Curve is our Facebook page. When we come back, we are going to go into the Winnipeg Jets trade value, spend a number of segments talking about that. Who's got the most value on the trade block, and who isn't as valuable as we might think? You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
Been listening to The Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast.
Catch The Illegal Curve Hockey Show live Saturdays on TSN 1290 and TSN1290.ca.